Welcome to Truest Blood, the official True Blood podcast.
I'm Kristen Bauer.
And I'm Deborah Ann Wohl.
And you've been invited in.
Welcome back to Truest Blood, where we sink our fangs into the series episode by episode.
Episode 206 Yay. Is titled Hard-Hearted Hannah. It was written by Brian Buckner and directed yet again by Michael Lehman.
So these episodes are starting to get jam-packed with content, and it is getting harder and harder to pull out the moments to highlight. But the theme this week seems to revolve around deception. The lies we tell others, the lies we tell ourselves, and that the truth really can hurt.
We also speak with Ashley Jones about her arc as Daphne Landry on season 2 of the show, which she did while simultaneously working on a soap opera, which is some of the hardest acting work out there. So this real-life Southerner never seems to stop working. There isn't a hit network show that she hasn't been on, like All Rise, The Mentalist, House, Bones, 902, and the list just goes on.
God, when does she rest? That is amazing.
She didn't, yeah.
But first, this week on True Blood.
Sookie and Hugo, Isabel's human companion, infiltrate the Fellowship of the Sun, where Sookie discovers that they are indeed holding Godric captive. But hold those horses, turns out the Newlands have been tipped off, and she and Hugo are dragged into the basement by the soldiers of the Sun. Meanwhile,
the shower isn't working at Sookie and Tara's house, and Marianne is not happy about it.
I don't know what to tell you. I wish I had a fancier crib for you to squat in, but I don't.
While Tara and Eggs drive across county lines for the hot water fix, Eggs has a strange case of deja vu. He treks them through the woods to discover a campsite with a creepy vibe that feels eerily familiar to him. When they return home, Marianne is mid-orgy. She transfixes the couple, who join in under her spell. Meanwhile,
Daphne is saying all the things Sam wants to hear.
You're just too damn special for him not to.
Where the fuck did you come from?
Things are hot, heavy, and downright animalistic as the pair enjoys each other's company. Until Daphne lures Sam towards some ominous drumming in the woods, only to finally reveal she's been working for Marianne all along. The orgy revelers hold Sam down as Carl approaches him with a big-ass knife. Meanwhile,
Andy visits Lafayette with some questions about his disappearance.
You weren't on any damn gay cruise. Because if you were, you would have come back with more pizzazz, not less.
The questioning triggers Lafayette's trauma, but luckily, Terry is there to comfort him. Until Pam shows up with an offer Lafayette cannot refuse. In Dallas, Eric has summoned Lorena to distract Bill from Sookie, and Lorena reminisces about the happier times with Bill, when all they did was sing, make love, and murder eager young socialites. Meanwhile,
Hoyt comes clean to his mother about the vampire he's been courting and then drives all the way to Dallas just to see her.
I'm so happy I could cry, but I don't want to because it's really gross when I do.
Finally, there's something for Jessica to do while in Dallas. At church camp, Jason is feeling all kinds of guilty about his come-to-Jesus moment with Sarah, but it turns out Steve is none the wiser. Jason briefly flirts with the idea of celibacy before Sarah's terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day thrusts her into his ever-loving arms right there on the church balcony. So, Deb, in this fabulous outline that you always prepare for us, that we all love so much, you have here Bill and Lorena flashback at the top. Yes. And those flashbacks are so kooky amazing. Oh,
they're really fun.
I mean, they're just off the charts.
And what a great opportunity for those actors too, you know, I think to get to play period pieces, to do something a little outside of the character. And what we get is Steve singing and playing the piano right off the bat, which is amazing.
Yeah, and he is actually playing and actually singing.
He is
an incredible singer.
Yeah, if,
and
you'll know he
pianist.
Did The Sound of Music live while he was on True Blood. It was towards the end of the show. Yeah. And he did that one during one of our hiatus. He also did a stage reading of Chicago for a special event at the Hollywood Bowl. So he's, you know, he's a professional singer and musician.
Yeah, so that's him at the piano. And, you know, we really get a look into who he was.
Right. Well, and this really vicious, sexual, impulsive side of him that Lorena brings out.
Yeah.
That just seems so antithetical to who Bill is now.
Yeah.
But it's funny watching it. I can see like why he's so rigid with Jessica. Why he's like, you know, he is trying to hold her back as much as he can from that world. Because he knows that that's an easy transition for a vampire. And also, you know, I don't know if Sookie is aware that that's part of his past, you know?
I know. We, as the audience, sure aren't. So we assume that she is not. Yeah. I mean, it's really, that was bold and shocking. And we learned so much more over this arc with Lorena. And I can't remember exactly which line is in which episode, but we find out that he really was strayed from who he had been as a human. And then he evolves back to, you know, a combination, but he craves his humanity again. Well, those, and so beautiful. Yeah. I mean, Mariana in these flashbacks.
Well, her accent is like sexy and right on and so interesting. I mean, I feel like they are glamoring that couple without glamoring. Like, Mariana and Steve Meyer need no superpowers to entice anyone into their bed. But I love, you know, at the end of it, it's so wonderful. But again, this sort of antithesis of who Bill is, or at least the Bill we know now, her lover has, you know, has been murdered in front of her. She's bleeding out on the bed and she looks up at them and she asks,
"Why are you doing this?"
"Well, because we can."
God, even listening to that, it sounds worse listening to it than watching it.
Yeah.
It's so
I know,
intense.
And then he like pulls her aside as she's dying, and then they're covered in blood and just have sex right there next to them on the
and
bed.
And there's a key moment there where he steals her necklace. And you'll notice that Lorena is wearing it in the present and continues to wear it throughout this season, which is such an incredible, you know, connection through. It really shows how much Bill means to her.
Yes, and they never comment on it, I don't believe.
Not really.
And it is really, that's another beautiful touch.
Yeah,
incredible.
I know it's in the script that she's wearing the necklace.
It is?
Yes.
Okay.
But whether that came before or after, you know, scripts get evolved and change all the time, so you're not always sure when it comes in. But they definitely had a plan to highlight that this vicious moment that they shared together that was also, for them, very romantic, really has stuck with her all this time.
Yep. And Jessica gets some romance.
Well, it all actually starts with Hoyt standing up to Maxine, which is a really fantastic scene.
Right.
I really love it. We're beginning to see a lot more of Hoyt and his story coming to the forefront. But yeah, it's interesting now that like Renee is dead, Jason is gone. Mm-hmm. You know, Hoyt's a bit on his own and he's having to kind of grow up a bit, maybe.
He is. And he is inspired to rise to be, you know, more manly.
Or at least go after what he
Jessica.
Wants. Yeah, oh, I suppose maybe.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he's getting some confidence.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I love it because, you know, so this is Maxine's, she's killed his phone. So she's controlling him. She's worried about appearances, all these things. And there's this great line that she gives about her reason for doing that.
Girls who call boys at all hours of the night like that are only looking for one thing, money.
We don't have any money.
That's not true. We're very comfortable.
It's the best.
She's so great.
She's so rich.
She is so wonderful.
Was that perfect setup? Because you expect her to say sex or something like that. But
totally.
But she's very concerned in front of her friend who's at the table, you know.
Yeah. And Hoyt doesn't back down.
No, he doesn't. He's really great. And I like even when he's angry at Maxine, he's still polite to her friend. That feels very Hoyt to me.
I know. Yeah. Oh my gosh. We just love Hoyt.
We really do. And we'll be speaking with Jim Perrick. So he's going to give us all the information on his take on Hoyt. Hoyt Fortenberry, and he and I get to catch up a bit later this season.
Yes.
But one thing I found interesting is in his last speech, he speaks about like his girlfriend, which I looked in the script and it's actually written Jessica. It's not written girlfriend.
Oh.
And that's an interesting switch. And it does mean, you know, it is a little different, that feeling. And I wondered, you know, sometimes lines get changed from script to script. So maybe I have an old version. Sometimes on set, though, they just come out organically a little different. And I think sometimes that can make really nice, subtle shifts for characters. And that Jim Parrick as Hoyt Fortenberry in some ways knows Hoyt and what he's thinking and feeling better than anyone else in the world. And if it comes out girlfriend instead of Jessica, that's coming from someplace true. And I'm so glad to see that, you know, when it matters, writers and directors and editors will keep the changed version in.
Yeah, because it's only one word, but it's a big deal. Yeah. Like if you think about in your own life, and it's very virginal.
Yeah.
You know,
it's innocent.
Right, the two of you.
We, you know,
right,
it's like we pinned each other, you know.
Yeah, it's like you pinned each other. Do you want to be my girlfriend? Yes. You know, it's just so funny. It's a huge word, probably as an adult too, when you're dating. I don't know, it's been so long, but you know, when someone starts saying, you know, you're out somewhere and they go, this is my girlfriend, Kristen, you're like, whoa, okay, this is a whole new deal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, I know. He labels it for his mother.
That's sweet.
Which is very sweet. And then, yes, he drives Dallas and it's very cute. And I like that Jessica is impulsively and angrily pouring True Blood down the drain despite Bill.
Yes, I thought that was too. And then I was like, well, I guess you've got the takeout menu there.
Yeah.
But I also thought, what's she going to drink? And then, you know, I commented to you, wait, how did you do the door thing? Because that is hard as an actor to have to spill things, have to fuddle with a door, and you have to do it many takes over. And I always have a radar for that when I'm watching. And you did such a good job of the impulsiveness of, oh my God, I got to get this door open. You know, you did such a good job.
I think part of it was on the day he's got more lines than I had space to cross or door to open, you know, and he's apologizing and stuff. So he can't really, I can't really get the door open until he's to that point. So we were like, how are we going to add more time? And the idea that maybe I couldn't get the door open was posed. But I remember saying, like, you can only fake that so far. You know, at a certain point, I had to be able to just see the lock and open it. But we decided to put the official door stop lock up top and that I would be too excited. So I said, I can give you one false open and then I have to open it. But then we go on, we have this really wonderful, you know, moment with Andy and Terry and Lafayette, where Lafayette is triggered by this. And then we even have Alex jumping in to kind of, you know, really nail that home. And then Terry is kind of a hero this episode in that moment.
What the hell, Andy? Back when we were kids and we used to play cops and robbers in Meemaw and Papo's backyard, you always used to make your arrest with dignity.
Yeah.
And again, a fantastic line.
I love
line.
The character.
Meemaw
and
Papo's.
Isn't that great? Right. And again, like the crazy lines that people said, but so grounded.
Yeah, really
I mean,
grounded.
Meemaw and Papo, I mean, so grounded. And really, I just love the character of Terry Belfleur coming out this season.
Yes. And that he gets down there, you know, as one of the few people who can really understand or at least recognize what's happening.
He recognizes it right away.
And he has some strategy that he can offer. And so much of the time people are acting like they have to take care of Terry or look out for him. And it's a really beautiful color on him to see him as the caretaker.
Yeah, it really was. Yeah.
And then you walk in and make things worse again for Lafayette.
You know, hey.
I have to say, that is a rich look, Kristen, in this one. Boy, do I love it.
Audrey Fisher had the sunglasses on the head idea.
Yeah, I love that.
And we thought that was pretty funny. We got a kick out of that. She can't go in the sun, of course.
Of course not. It's just
right, the one person who does not need sunglasses.
It's an accessory. Yeah.
It's an accessory.
Well, I wanted to ask because I had this thought. I was like, so is Pam the kind of person who, like, no matter whether she's lounging at Fantasia all day or whether she's going out, still gets dressed to the nines? Or is this like you're on your way to someplace cooler and just stopped by to terrify someone at Merlot's?
In the book, Pam had two looks.
Okay.
She had her, like, knit sort of matching sets for day, and then she had her Fantasia look.
Yeah.
And that ended up evolving over the years because we started with, when we staked Long Shadow, I was in J. Crew, like a pink sweater and khakis.
Sure. Right. Which I love.
Sure.
I'm sorry. I mean, my favorite might be the Stepford Wife Pam.
Yes, and that is exactly it. And then it became juicy sweats a lot. So that was her day look. So she's probably, you know, she's out in the world. Yeah. So she's not going to go out in her juicy sweats.
She's got someplace cool to be. And she just had to be like, oh, I'll just drop by and force Lafayette
just drop
to sell
by and
me
torture this
me.
Idiot. Yeah.
I just love, I mean, it seems like Pam just owns every room she enters. Even if that room is a walk-in freezer, it belongs to Pam.
I know, she's looking at it. I like this room.
I could use this in a pinch.
Yeah, that was a fun scene.
Yeah. I wonder if that's not a foreshadow, is it? Do you ever use the walk-in freezer at Merlot's for a daytime hideout?
I don't, but I do have a fabulous bunch of dialogue in there again, torturing Lafayette.
Right, okay.
Right. I can't remember. Maybe I smile too much. Maybe I wear too much pink. Right. That happens.
That's right.
And that's another great one. And she's in another, you know, outfit where she's out doing Eric's business. But she's not going to go out in her juicy sweats.
She's not. She would be caught dead in her juicy sweats.
It was bound to happen.
I'm surprised we haven't done it yet. And I think at the end here, you know, we come up on this insane orgy scene. I mean, the orgy stuff's about to really take off here. And you'll hear, we speak with a number of people who were part of those scenes. So you'll hear a lot of stuff about those scenes from our different guests that we have on this season.
Yes. I mean, Raelle, when we interviewed her, right? Yes. She has an interesting family background where she says her mom was in a cult. Yep. She saw a lot of naked people running around when it was full moon.
Worshipping, yes.
Worshipping the moon. And, you know, it's in the books, you know, probably this orgy stuff. But, you know, the True Blood style, they went for it.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's one of those things where you watch it and you're like, this is crazy. And for sure, the show bumps it up a little bit. But to remember that, you know, Raelle experienced some form of this kind of, you know, midnight freedom with her family. And so, you know, it's one of those like life can be stranger than fiction kind of moments.
Exactly. Exactly.
And now for a quick bite. Movie Magic, the Magic Hour.
The magic hour in filmmaking, also sometimes referred to as the golden hour, is that brief hour just before the sun dips below the horizon in the evening, or conversely, the hour just after the sun has risen in the morning.
The daylight at that angle in the sky is filtered through more of the Earth's atmosphere, creating a more diffused and warmer light than the direct sunlight during midday. It generally makes everything look, well, magical, making it a much coveted natural effect in cinematography.
But it is no small feat to capture this elusive light. You have only 1 hour to work with. The light is constantly incrementally shifting. Cloud cover, any number of other environmental factors can kill the effect. But this episode, we see a brilliant example of capturing the magic hour when Steve Newland throws open the doors to the light of day church.
So to get this shot, the scene would be rehearsed extensively to minimize mistakes or retakes. Coverage facing the window is prioritized since the turnaround can be faked with artificial light if you have to. And everything would be set and ready to go so action can be called the minute the light is right. So there's this Southern saying that I found that says, better to be slapped with the truth than kissed with a lie. Which is pretty fantastic. But I wonder if our characters this episode would agree or not. The truth is pretty bitter this episode. There's a lot of lying going on, and everyone kind of gets outed by the end of this. And, you know, I think the lies have quite a different flavor as we look at each one.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, really, everyone is lying. Yep. Eric is lying. Lorraine is lying. All the truth ends up coming out. Mm-hmm. Jason's lying. Both Newlands are lying.
Eggs was lied to.
Hugo's lying.
Oh, Daphne. Oh, boy. Quite a lot of lying going on there. But that's kind of what I think is interesting, right? Because we would say, like, so lying, you know, on a basic level, you could say objectively is a bad thing, right? But I would say the lying that Daphne is doing is a little bit different than the lying that Sookie is doing. And so how, you know, as we look at it from these different angles, I love that the writers and Brian Buckner are showing us that this thing we think is objective is actually way more complex.
Completely. Yeah. Lying is not 100% bad and vice versa.
There's also an interesting little tidbit to this. So this episode was originally titled Friend is a Four-Letter Word for the Song by Cake, which is interesting. Hmm. So at some point in there, it got changed, maybe because of Steve Moyer's performance at Hard-Hearted Hannah. But it's interesting. That song, the lyric suggests that end part of the word is all that they hear, which is sort of a fascinating idea that when you say friend, all they hear is end. So it's fascinating. Yeah. And I pulled out a few examples here of, I think, very different angles on this idea of deception. So first up, we have Sarah and Jason, who have this sort of hidden attraction. Mm. It's the day after the holy hand job.
I love it when you say that, by the way.
Oh, I just, do too. I mean, that is all that scene is for me.
Yeah.
Jason is racked with guilt.
He's racked with guilt. He's confused.
He's really confused. And she's actually handling it quite a bit better.
Yeah.
So much that Jason is sure that he's going to get punished.
Right.
And then he has this wonderful conversation with Luke.
Right, because adultery's bad.
One of the worst. Right up there with incest and bestiality. But all of them put together ain't half as bad as if you do it to a vampire. Or to a dude. Or a vampire dude. That's like cream de la cream of the sins. Ain't no repentance for that.
Uh-huh.
Yep. Okay. Clear. Laid out.
Boy.
This is why I'm jealous of people who find religion to work really well for them.
Goodness.
In its entirety. Because you just have it laid out.
It's real easy. This is the rules. There's a hierarchy of sin. This feels like an Alan Ball tweak line to me. I mean, Bucky gets full credit, but this also feels like one where Alan is like championing it or potentially tweaking.
Well, the bestiality is just to throw that in there and to have Ryan's reaction is so funny. He's like,
bestiality. Oh my God. Which is my favorite is that from this conversation, Jason decides to be celibate for about six hours.
6.2 seconds. Yeah. And I love how he says, you know, celibate. And then Luke says, doesn't that feel good or whatever? And he goes, no.
So that's sort of Jason's story. He's sort of hiding this thing. He doesn't really tell, you know, Luke what happens. He's hiding all of these feelings and this, you know, sinful thing that he did.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, Steve is being so dismissive and kind of cruel to Sarah all episodes. And she's holding on to this secret of infidelity.
Yeah.
And it's funny. Steve calls Sookie the C word as he's pulling her down the stairs. And Anna Camp has the best reaction. It's like Sarah is so much more shocked by him using the C word than she even is by the fact that he's kidnapping people right in front of her.
And she tells that to Jason later.
Yeah.
Later she does. When she's seducing him.
Yes. Well, that, you know, that's what makes him the man, you know, not the man she thought he was.
Right.
Not the kidnapping. Not the potential murder.
Yeah, because she knew about that plot.
Right.
Right?
Right.
But the C
word, that's new. She was reluctantly going along with that.
Yeah, that's new information.
New information for her.
Okay.
So, yeah, so there's this question, you know, she allows herself to, you know, succumb to Jason's, the temptation of Jason's Stackhouse. You know, so now the question becomes, you know, do they come clean? Does Steve have to know? Does he deserve to know? Have they done anything wrong? I mean, there's a lot of secrecy. I mean, adultery at its heart is this sort of lying and keeping things from someone you made a promise to. And but again, you know, if he's treating them a certain way, that complicates things.
Yeah, it complicates things. It was enough. I love that scene, the way it was shot too, where she's seducing him up there in the church balcony, right? They switch positions. So she's on the right and then she's on the left and then she's on the right. So she's literally twisting him around over and over into, no, this isn't wrong. And of course it doesn't take a lot, right? But but in her mind.
He's been celibate for 6 hours.
He's celibate for six. That's a long time.
It's all built up.
Yeah. So she, and in there she says something like, he said the C word. So he's not the man I was supposed to be with. I knew God wanted me to be behind a wonderful, powerful man. It's not him. I was wrong. But it's you. So you get it, right? She's really hot and horny for Jason and just making a whole new story to make it not cheating, really, basically.
And so she's, I think that is the perfect example of her lying to herself.
Yeah.
You know, she doesn't want to feel bad about this thing that she wants and yeah. is going to do. So she rewrites her narrative,
yeah.
which is, you know, a lie to make herself feel better about it. And it was interesting. I remember speaking with Scott Winant because he was working on The Affair.
Yeah.
And he was like, you know, the interesting thing is we forgive murder on television right. so quickly.
We do.
It's harder for us to forgive adultery. And that's right. so interesting because clearly there's a hierarchy between those two things.
Sure.
You know. But he said what's interesting is that if you're in a room of 20 people, probably no one has murdered anyone.
Right.
But per statistics, 50% right. have done some form of infidelity.
Right.
So there's a more personal element to it that makes us judge it in others as worse to make ourselves maybe feel better about yes. whatever we've done.
Or guilt. You know, it's yeah.
Yeah. So we rewrite our own stories even just in watching it and how we feel about this act. So, you know, it's interesting right. watching this, what feelings come up for people when they see Jason and Sarah, you know, take this step.
Right, right. Like if Bill cheated on Sookie, I'd be much madder. But because I don't like Steve Newlin and I feel for right. Ryan, I'm like, ah, go right. for it.
Right. But, you know, hey, it's still the same.
It's still the same
in
thing.
A way, you know, it's the same thing. So it's same transgression. So it's just fascinating.
It is.
So then, you know, the next example we see now is Eggs. Now, this is a very different situation. He's been lied to and it's super messed up because he doesn't even know what the lie is.
Yeah.
The lie is that he's happy.
Right.
And, you know, this is one of these ones where he deserves to know the truth, but it is going to shatter him
right.
when he finds out.
Yeah, that's one where you hope he doesn't find yeah. out. But of course, it's true.
You
blood.
Hope, but, or do you? Because.
Or do you? Because he now half knows.
He half knows. And gosh, I mean, to not know a part of your life, a part of who mm-hmm. you are, that's a real theft. Of someone, you know, mm-hmm. and in a way, even if the truth is horrible, but then, you know, we'll see at the end of the season. I mean,
yeah, we're going to find out. We're going to
well
find
for
out
for him. So
you would almost always choose knowing, but since we know what he's going to know, we're like, abort, abort, don't know.
Turn back. But anyways, I think in a way, Tara, I think, puts it really succinctly as they're walking through the woods.
I don't know, ain't a place, Eggs. It's a state of mind. A state of mind I don't like being in.
Yeah.
Right? It's scary.
That's well written.
It's scary to not know.
It's terrifying.
And to feel like something's being kept from you that's important and vital.
And lack of control. Yeah. Yeah, that's a tough one.
A slightly less tough one, a slightly more potentially black and white example here.
But awful.
Is Sam and Daphne.
Yeah.
I have this feeling that ignorance really was bliss for Sam, and he would have let Daphne lie to him a little longer.
Oh, totally. Gosh. And we just, as an audience, we're torn, right? Because you're like, oh
God.
What does he say? He's like, you're the most incredible person I've ever met.
I know. I mean, it's just... we're tipped off a little bit when she turns into that pig and then Andy recognizes her.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I mean, Ashley Jones, who we're going to talk to in a minute, does the most amazing job of just like throwing it off. Like, of course, that's what you call pig. Like, I don't suspect her for a minute.
And then she goes down
on him,
right?
And of course, she manages to find the perfect way to distract him from looking into that too deeply.
Yeah, she's like, whatever.
Mm-hmm. What's fascinating about it is the first scene, that beautiful scene with the two of them on the pool table where you watch them fall in love and you love her and him as much as they're starting to love each other. She has a speech about authenticity.
It's like, why take the risk?
Because not taking risk is riskier.
That's just wordplay.
No, it's not. The way I look at it, if you're gonna take the danger out of getting to know someone, might as well not bother with them at all. You've gotta share this life with people. That's what we were put on this big old round ball to do. And people, they need to know you.
You're just too damn special for him not to.
Where the fuck did you come from?
My heart's breaking for Sam.
I know. When I love you, she has this idea that, like, you know, what we're both feeling right now only feels that way because everything's on the table.
Right.
And looking back at that speech, and she looks so genuine.
I know.
And yet we know now that not nearly everything was on the table at that moment.
And, but don't you wonder in hindsight, you're like, but yeah. She had to be falling for him. She just had, you know, a god that she had to serve.
Right.
So that's the justification and the purpose. But she had to fall for Sam at least a little bit.
Well, it's that. And, you know, Ashley, I think, says it when we speak with her later, that it can be both.
Right.
She can think that luring him into Marianne's world is actually good for him because she worships Marianne and it's a cult. And but I think for Sam, it's pretty clearly
it's
a lot less
upside.
Complex for him. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
And then finally, we have the biggest liars of the liars this episode. We have Sookie as well as the Newlands.
Yeah.
They are all lying to each other on multiple levels.
Yeah.
It's really fascinating. I mean, I think actually my favorite part of it is the kind of false cheeriness of it all.
Oh, yeah.
I cannot believe I'm actually meeting you in person. You are cute as a button.
Well, thank you, Holly. And you're like a cool breeze on a hot summer day. Quit.
Oh, my God. I just love her.
Meanwhile, Sookie knows that she's a vampire-hating bitch. And Sarah Newland knows that she's an infiltrating, you know, lying sneak. You know, like, just...
Well, and at
amazing.
This point, I did have another one of those moments where I was like, does Sookie not watch the show? Because she knows that they are the ones who tried to kidnap her, right? So apparently she's trusting that they don't have a photo.
Well, remember the limo driver said they don't know who the vampire companion is. They just said, capture the one that's with the vampires. He didn't even know she was going to be a woman.
Right.
So they have sort of, you know, the writers did their due diligence.
That's true.
In that they set it up that they have some idea. But what they don't know is that there is obviously a mole, which we'll find out more about upcoming.
Upcoming, speaking of liars.
Yes. Speaking of liars, yes. So, yeah, it's really interesting. And it's interesting seeing Sookie, you know, have to kind of play the vampire hater. And she has an interesting comment about that as well.
Hugo, I don't just hear the things that hateful people say. I hear the things that are so hateful that hateful people don't even want to say them out loud. Don't you worry about me. I've got plenty of material to work with. I'll be fine.
Good.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I had another thought that I can't, like, yeah, I have to save it for, you know, Sookie's mind reading. Right?
Yeah.
Right? Because you're like, use it more. Use it now. Do you not watch
the show? Spent so much of her life trying to not use it, right?
Exactly.
Like it's an impediment. So she's just every second fighting not to use it.
Yeah.
You know, she gets slapped with people's worst truth every day of her life. So she's just trying to
only
hold
tune
back,
in but when it's necessary.
Yeah.
For brief moments.
And it's interesting.
Yeah.
You know, she, as they're at the Fellowship of the Sun, She catches the information that she wants, which is, you know, Steve Newland's thinking it at just the right time in his office.
Yes.
He's having a stare out the window and she just glances in there and gets exactly the information she needs.
Yeah.
But then later, and I love that what she hears is him saying, I wonder if she's listening to me right now. You know, like that, you know, they know she's a telepath. They know it's her.
Right.
They are onto them.
Yeah, they know. Right. Exactly. And that is when, as the viewer, we're like, wait, how? Wait, what?
And how do you get out of that? Right.
Like, how do you get out of that?
Because they call, just turn and run. But they can't. And so they keep playing this game.
Yeah. They called in the big guy.
Both of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Both of them know the jig is up.
Yeah.
But they're just continuing to play this dance, hoping one of them can outmanipulate the other to win.
Right.
So fun.
Yeah, that's a really, really fun sequence. Yeah, yeah, yep. So much good stuff coming up. Lots of deception on every level comes more to the fore.
So So today we have Ashley Jones with us to talk about her role as Daphne Landry on the show. And I, you know, this was such an interesting interview because neither of us worked with her. So we didn't get to see her work on the stages, but yet we got close to her. As we've said with so many of these interviews, we knew everyone. And I just remember, you know, she's got that beautiful Southern charm in her voice.
She does. She does. Yeah. She still does.
She still does. And such a strong intellect. And I just remember being really excited to meet her. And now watching her, you can see all of that just shine through in this performance, which is quite difficult.
Yeah.
So without further ado, Ashley Jones.
Ashley!
Oh, my goodness.
Yay!
This is so much fun for me to see your faces.
Yes, likewise. Oh, it's so
Well, we've been staring at your face nonstop for the last couple of weeks, so we're excited to actually get to talk to you and find out how you did all of this amazing work.
This is very fun for me. Well, I have to say, I have been listening to some of the podcasts you guys have done just in preparation for this, and it kind of brought me to tears a little bit last night because, you know, I was nostalgic and I was listening to some stuff and it just brought back so many memories.
Yeah, that's it.
That's what we hope. I mean, that's what's been fun for us, I think, in having everyone on to talk. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone has just been saying how much they missed it, what a positive time it was in their life.
For me, it was like a landmark in my life.
Wow.
It really was. It was this really fun thing that I got to do and be a part of. And honestly, all of those moments I look back and very few times in my life would I go back and say, I'd be willing to do it all over again because it was really fun. You know, for listeners, we had trailers set up and we would be doing sometimes one or two shows at the same time and they would overlap. Yeah. So I got to see actors that I wouldn't normally get to see. And those were really fun memories. And that's how I connected to a lot of the cast because I was primarily, you know, my scenes were mainly with Sam.
Yep.
And a little with Anna, a little with Carrie. I had some great moments with Carrie. And Rutina and I actually got quite close. But a lot of my stuff was mainly in Merlot's and then the back lot of the WB. And no one was there except for crew and Sam. And, you know, the audience doesn't know that. So.
Yeah. Well, we've talked a lot about, too, the table reads being this, like, watering hole.
Well, that's where we all would chat forever and learn about each other and figure out if we were going to hang out later or just say hi. The table reads were actually they were some of my favorite memories because that's where I got to really connect with everyone else. We were all commenting on different things and we were all wondering what was happening next. And, you know, this is an interesting show because, you know, maybe it was just for me because I was limited on the episodes, but I didn't always know where my storyline was going.
So I'm so curious to hear about that from you because yours is such a big twist.
Yes.
A huge twist.
Would have sworn to God that you knew the entire time because there are moments that just like reek of subtext, you know? And you're like, oh, she's playing something.
So I was begging Alan to tell me what was, I knew there was a big moment, but I didn't know what it was.
Oh my
gosh. Did you know you were related in some way connected with Marianne?
I did not until, no, I never knew that.
Oh my gosh.
Around episode 3 or 4, I was dying. I was asking all the writers and Alex Wu, one of our writers, would kind of come in and chat with me sometimes. And I finally found out, my agent actually got word that I was the pig. And it's so funny when it was such a big moment in my life when I remember where I was on set when I got the text, you're the pig. Oh my God, you're the pig. And who would ever be like, can you imagine getting that moment? You're like, wait, what does that mean? And who would, and if you don't watch the show, it sounds like, oh, you're a pig.
No, and it's very cool.
It was extremely cool. And then I was dying to know how that intertwined with everything. Cause in my mind, I was a deer because I was playing the shapeshifter that, and then I learned shapeshifters can shape into multiple entities. Right. But so far I'd only really been put on film or tape, however we call it now in our day, as a deer. And so I was like, oh my God, I'm the pig. And that like brought all of these new things to my mind. And I immediately went home when I finished filming and went back and watched all of that. And I was like, what do I do with this information? And I was like, how do I bring this into my character? And maybe you guys got like outlines in some of the other shows I've done. I've gotten really great outlines, and I know, you know, the arc.
Okay.
And especially a movie, as an actor with a movie, you know, the arc, mm-hmm. but with this particular show, my character was slightly Machiavellian.
Mm-hmm. Yes, slightly. Mm-hmm.
But I really didn't realize that for a few episodes. And what was the beauty of that? And I understand and I appreciate that now. I was allowed to have these moments with Sam and fall in love with him.
Right. Yeah.
For all the right reasons.
Right.
And it gave us a real human moment that was really beautiful.
Beautiful.
Well, and there's something about Daphne, and particularly in that portrayal of it, that made me think she can be both.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing that says she can't fall in love with Sam and be doing Marianne's bidding.
Right.
I think I was playing both sides. I think Daphne actually fell in love with Sam, and I think mm-hmm. she actually was, the word worship is a little bit strong, but I mm-hmm. think she was answering to Marianne.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And how fun to play all that stuff with Michelle Forbes. But at the time, it was beautiful because I was allowed to just be we were two shapeshifters that were falling in love and had a commonality. Yes. And Sam hadn't found that yet in the show and his storyline. Yeah. And he found that with Daphne. And Daphne definitely found that with him. And I think that in time, I played it that, you know, I think she was trying to turn him in the end. I think she didn't want to leave Sam. I think she wanted him to come with her, but I don't think she knew her final fate.
Yeah. No, yeah, no, that seemed like a big...
It doesn't feel that
mm-hmm,
way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You have that wonderful line saying about like being a part of something divine is worth dying for.
And yes.
You saved him. And in my mind, I'm going, oh, but that's what happens to her.
And I don't know. I think even then, I don't know that I knew as an actor that this character was dying. So I think I didn't know for a long time. And I think that, I don't know, we'd have to ask Alan and the writers. I don't know when they decided that, mm-hmm. but it became a plot point that was very important in the scope of everything. Yeah. So when I was able to say that, I think in my mind, I was hoping he would come to my side of it all. You
mm-hmm.
know?
Yeah. Sure.
Oh, so interesting.
It says one of the lines was, I used to be scared and stupid, just like you. She could have killed me. I deserved it. But she saw something in me. She saved
me,
gave me a whole new life. Oh, no fear, no limits, just love.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. I remember this.
And we've had, you know, Deb always finds wonderful themes, and our producer Gabby too. And we've been talking about searching for family and, you know, lost characters and
looking for belonging.
Looking for belonging.
I mean, right? I have to say it's a great metaphor for life too.
It
you know?
Is. Isn't
the
it?
More
it
you
your
live
heart.
Your life, it breaks your heart in a little bit or a lot of bits. You know, in the longer I live, the more I've gone through in life, and I go back and think about these things, especially because I've been listening to a few of your podcasts, and it's incredibly relatable.
It's right. It is.
Well, let's jump back a little bit. I'd love to hear your audition story. So how did you get the part? How much were you aware of the show? Did that, you know, affect it? What was your sort of story? How did you come into the True Blood fold?
You know, by the time I auditioned for the role, True Blood aired. And by the time it was done airing, it was a big deal. So people were watching, and it was just growing in numbers, and people started talking about it, and it was a hub. I started watching it, and I really thought, oh, I'd love to be a part of the show. I was a series regular on a soap opera, Bold and the Beautiful, and I had a major storyline. I was on the air every day, and it didn't seem feasible for me to be on the show.
Right.
But I told my agents, and my agents were watching it, and my agent, Stephen Chang, just loved the show. And so Stephen said, let me call them and see what we can do, and maybe we can carve out, you know, add some outs and whatever. But I was a series regular on a show, and that's a big deal, as we all know as an actor. That's a contract. You don't break. It's with CBS and Viacom. And
particularly soap operas, which is a
daily activity.
A constant work. Yeah.
Yeah.
And back then, this has been a while, we didn't get a ton of time off like they do now, the way they film it. So anyway, I listened to my agents and they said, let's just audition and see where this goes. So
oh
remember, I go in, I recognized Alan Ball and I sat down and I did my read and you leave, right? Mm-hmm. And they're like, thank you so much for coming in. And you're like, oh, okay. Is there anything else I can do for you? Sometimes I say that. Sometimes I don't. I don't even know if I said it then. I think I was like, okay, great. So I go back. I literally leave. So my audition was at The Lot, which is in Hollywood. But it was a little bit East Hollywood. And then I had to go back and film a scene on Bold and the Beautiful, which is more West Hollywood. So for listeners, it actually is not that far in proximity. But with traffic, it can be actually quite far. So there's a lot of anxiety. Yes. I went on a break.
Oh my God.
These people, well, the good news is all these people were rooting for me because they all watched True Blood.
So I had
stage managers and people in the booth and all these people and actors all like on a group text, like, I'm coming, please stall, like, I'm coming back. So I get back.
What an incredible support system.
That's just like True Blood is a family. Bold and Beautiful is a family. So I'm finishing my scenes. I have a ton of scenes left that day. And I get a call from my agent. They want you to come back. You're in the mix.
Oh my gosh.
As actors, we know what that means. We're in the mix. For listeners, it's that's so exciting. It means they liked you.
Yeah.
But I'm going to go back and read with Sam. And so I went back and I remember it was a big moment because I was in between scenes for Bold and Beautiful and they didn't know I was auditioning for this. So I run to The Lot and I run on and, you know, it's like all that anxiety. There's people in front of you as you're trying to get on and please let me in. I need to do my audition. And you get there and you have to wait because that's our business. Yep. You hurry up and wait.
Yeah.
And I see the other people auditioning for the role, reading with Sam. Can't remember who they are, but I felt very like, oh, in your head as an actor, if you're not super, super confident and super in your own world, all of a sudden you're like, oh, they'd be great for the role.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Mm.
Oh, yeah.
I had to go outside and I called my agent, Stephen Jang, and I said, I need a little assistance here. And he's brilliant. And so he said, do you want to just run lines again and remember? And we ran lines and there's a line and I don't remember what episode it was, but the line is, I know what you are.
Yes. You whispered in his ear in the kitchen and it's such a great moment.
It's very, very sexy and scary and all the things.
Yes. And it really foreshadows a lot of Daphne. It's a really important moment. And I kept saying when I was running lines, I kept saying, I know who you are. I know who you are. Mm-hmm. He said, you need to take a deep breath. I want you to get your bearings of where you are. And I want you to come into the moment as Daphne. The line is, I know what you are. And I'll never forget that because it really reminded me of how important words are that writers put on the page.
Yeah.
And especially in our show, and especially when you're reading something from Alan Ball and people that he's hired to write his vision, they're very specific with things.
Yes.
And it really grounded me for a moment when my agent said that. And he said, I want you to try to see if you can whisper that in Sam's ear.
Because
this is a party scene.
Yeah.
I want you to go in. I want you to really, really put yourself in this moment. And it really grounded me. I had no more anxiety. I had no more whatever.
Wow.
I go back in the room. They call me in. And the first thing I said was, they said, you know, Hi, do you have any questions? You know how they say. And Sam's in there. And I said, my only question is, how close can I get to Sam?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Sam said, you can get as close as you want.
Oh.
I said, okay. And I said, can you pull your chair up a little closer? And he and he did. You know, we have to make sure that the camera's not blocking me and can also see him and our reaction. And I didn't worry about the cameras for this particular one. I was like, come closer, come closer. So then we did the scene and I leaned over. I was not disrespectful, but I leaned over and whispered in his ear, I know what you are. And I pulled back and the reaction of Sam was so fun. And I remember reacting to that because it was like, wait, you know what I am? And it was like, we shared this incredible moment in Sudish. It was like, he said, you know what I am. And then I said, I know what you, and we kind of repeat. I think we ad-libbed a tiny bit in the audition because it was a really fun moment of like, we were both shapeshifters.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the crux of how we connected.
And on screen, that moment is quite something between you two.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the way they translated it to screen, I have to give it to Alan and the directors and the editors. It's a fun moment. Mm-hmm. And it really, what it does, it's so brilliant. And now that I'm behind the camera a little bit, it's so brilliant because you tell so much in 30 seconds.
And it's such an interesting story to have had that experience in the audition and then have to know, oh, wait, that's not for 5 episodes, you know? So now we're going to go back and play actual strangers where I'm just going to ask for a job and I'm just going to be the, you know, the quote unquote ditzy waitress.
That's exactly what it is. And you do that a lot in what we do for a living. And you have to go back and forget all of that and go back and, my family loved, I'm from the South.
Yes, I wanted to ask because this is the craziest thing to me.
Very authentic South.
Very authentic South. And your dad, I mean, it totally interrupted you because I'm so excited, but like you are from Tennessee, but your dad is a preacher in Texas.
Yeah, he started out in Tennessee. And I mean, if you get me talking, I'll sound just like I did on the show. That's how my family talks. I just spent some time in Texas and then I went to South Carolina. And I mean, it's real. It's a real deep connection to the South.
Yeah.
And when we go on these little road trips to see different family members, our favorite place is to stop at Crackle Barrel.
And that line and so is so funny.
My first line is, well, have you, you know, I don't remember the exact thing, but Sam says something like, well, have you ever waited tables before? I'm like, well, yeah, I've served at Crackle Barrel. And if anyone's ever been to Crackle Barrel, you don't really serve at Crackle Barrel.
Right.
And so it was a really fun thing for me, but it was very real. A lot of it was based in Louisiana, but my character was actually from Texas or so we thought because of Crackle Barrel and then she came over. So it was a real East Texas, Deep South. It's just Southern Texas. It's just a little, you know, and see, I'm sure I'm saying, sounding like it. It's all country.
It's a little country. And what was your family's reaction to the show?
We have never discussed it. I don't know that they have fully watched it.
Yep.
I'm sure people have. I think my dad has seen snippets. You know, there are a couple of scenes that I just don't know my parents ever really need to see. The pool table scene is.
Sure. Yeah. Yep.
You know, sex scenes are specific, you know, and it's, we don't always want our families seeing all of that. My stuff with Sam was so safe. That's the only word I can say, that it didn't seem like it was even, I was exposing myself or anything.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's the tricky thing about True Blood that kind of, you know, you think, ooh, we're getting into this sexy show and everyone's going to be naked. But then, I mean, the scene that you had on the pool table with Sam afterwards is beautiful.
It's really beautiful.
The only thing salacious about it is that you guys are naked, but we don't see anything. Like, it's this
shadows. Michael Lehman directed that episode.
It's gorgeous.
And Michael did a beautiful job doing it. And there were a lot of shadows. There was the sexiness of the pool table. We, you know, and we made sure the light was hung in the right place. I mean, there was a lot of thought. It spread over 2 episodes, kind of. And that's a director's job. It's a DP's job. It's our job. It's all these people. And then everyone on set was so, you know, our wardrobe team was amazing.
Amazing.
I think at that time it was Audrey and Montana and I was covered the minute they said cut.
Yeah.
So you don't feel like you're doing anything salacious.
You don't.
Well, and frankly, the scene, the conversation you're having, the content of that conversation is more vulnerable than the nudity, you know?
Yeah.
Like really what I'm seeing and focused on is your souls and this connection that you're forming.
And I remember, I don't know if you remember how they all did, I'm sure you guys do, but Michael had a lot of them had a way of doing things. And Michael had a specific way, Michael Lehman directing, and he wanted us to like get in the moment. And then he would say, let's just run the scene real fast and see how it sounds.
Right.
And we'd run the scene. I went up to him afterward and I said, are there any notes? And I ran the scene like I was running lines. I really didn't. I looked at Sam and reacted and responded, but it wasn't like I was trying to act. And Michael said, don't do anything different.
Oh.
And I was like, well, I mean, no, I was literally just running the lines. I wasn't doing anything. He's like, I don't need to do anything. And coming from a soap, sometimes I feel like I need to do something. And then when we really got in the moment, all it was just a small conversation, opening up and being vulnerable, opening your heart. And Sam saw her and she saw Sam. And it was beautiful. And it really connected with the storyline in the audience. And I'll never forget it. It was a really fun time to,
Sam, I think, is so present.
Sam is very, very special that way. I just had such a connection with him as an actor. Mm-hmm. You really, like, and the way you said it, he's so present. He's mm-hmm. so present that you mm-hmm. forget where you are, what you're doing. Mm-hmm. You forget everything around you when you're working with him. When you look in his eyes, you are just in that moment.
I did have a giggle in that moment that seemed so specific, and it really helped the lighting be beautiful. But, you know, when he turns the light off on the pool table above,
yeah.
it just seems so funny. You know, let's yeah. turn out the light, and it's the light above the pool table.
It's a funny moment
and relax.
It's romantic and yes. ridiculous. And
yeah, totally.
And that was definitely, I think we didn't want to do that. I think we tried to get rid of that, but it was a cinematic moment that they wanted. And I think they were going to yeah. do an effect. And that's the part of what we do that we have to, you know, suspension of disbelief.
I did want to ask about your death scene. And like how you found out you were dying. And then, you know, in the moment when you die, is there a little smile?
There's a smile because, oh my goodness, I forgot who directed me, but whoever directed me said, you feel like you're doing your life's work.
Right.
It was my loyalty to Marianne.
Yes.
My loyalty to, you know, Michelle Forbes' character, mm-hmm. and Macaud Brooks, that I adore and love and still keep in touch with a little bit. You know, he came in and did that. It was that we had to really rehearse that. And, you know, all these things on True Blood, you don't want to get hurt. So you have these stunt people coming in showing you how to do it. And I was like, I can't. Mm-hmm. It was a very sad moment for me because I kept thinking like, wait, is this the end? And they brought me back a couple of times, but I was dead in a freezer.
Right.
But they chose for me not to be scared.
Yeah.
Because I just think that this character was really under the claws of Marianne. Mm-hmm. And she felt like she was fulfilling her mission.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see them eat Daphne's heart over Sloppy Joe's. And I think the audience went crazy over that. Not because they wanted Daphne. It was just like, it was a little sensational and a little oh my goodness. Right. And that was kind of the concept of the show. It was, there were always, it were small moments. They weren't, I mean, some moments were over the top, but it was a shocking, they liked to keep the audience like that moment of awe. Yeah. And they did a great job with that. I don't think anyone expected Daphne to die quite like that.
Mm-hmm. No.
So that was a big moment for the second season. And then they went into, you know, different, it kept getting more and more shock and awe. And it was really brilliant on the writer's part. Of course, I was devastated and wanted to stay with you guys forever.
I know.
But that's the beauty of what happens with these stories. They're stories.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I couldn't agree more. Thank you. Thank you. And I have one other question for you. We've been asking everyone. And that is, when you think of your experience on the show, shooting the show, what are three words that come to mind?
Brilliant. Because I was working with brilliant people.
Yeah.
A learning.
Yep.
And lifetime.
Those
are my three words.
It's so interesting. And that goes with everything you told us.
Oh, I should have said, although I love what I said, I should have said the word unforgettable, but a brilliant will work.
Yeah.
Can we change it?
We'll give you four.
Well, give me four. Unforgettable. Because that's what it was. Yeah. It was an unforgettable landmark in my life. And I love that I get to come back here and chat with you guys about it. You are both so special.
Thank you. It's so good to see you and to hear your experience. Yeah, we really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate you guys. Love you and sending you big hugs.
So I think the Workaholic Award is going to Ashley Jones for season 2 of True Blood and season upteen for Bold and the Beautiful.
Right? I mean, that's the
staggering
thing.
That she
could
do, also not just get through it, but do such a deeply moving job, you know, in both circumstances.
And go after the role and embrace that. And I mean, that was really a chess game.
It was.
Yeah. And how fun once again to like, you know, I didn't get to work with her. I didn't get to know her terribly well. how fascinating and wonderful to connect with, you know, our extended family.
And to know that, you know, it really is just good people, all just good people. So yes, thank you to her for taking the time. And it's just been such a pleasure watching her work.
I know. Likewise. 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 Thank you, Ashley.
Next week on Truest Blood, our characters are separated and locked up. We'll look at how the filming gave us all claustrophobia and how sometimes being trapped can open one's mind to some hard truths.
And we have the remarkable Mariana Clavino with us. You know her as Lorena, the alluring and slightly unhinged maker of Bill Compton. But you may also have caught her on Devious Maids, Stalker, and she's on the upcoming Superman and Lois series.
I cannot wait to hear all about those intoxicating flashbacks.
Yes.
So thanks for listening, Truvies. Subscribe and follow wherever you listen to your podcasts, and we'll see you next week.
Y'all come back now, you hear.
Got any burning questions you want answered on Truest Blood? Post them on any and all social media platforms using hashtag FangClubQuestions, and we may feature them on the show. That's hashtag FangClubQuestions. Truest Blood is produced by Safe Haven for HBO Max. Executive producers are Janina Kavankar, Kristen Bauer, and Deborah Ann Wool. Our producer is Gabrielle Galan, and our audio producer is Christopher Wool. Our theme song was recorded just for this podcast by Jace Everett. Additional music was composed by Timo Chen. And remember, you can watch all of the original episodes of True Blood on HBO Max.